Hey everybody, welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast by Bald Move. We're the officially unofficial podcast for HBO's Game of Thrones television series, as well as George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, Volume 1, as well as the officially official podcast for our new book, Gods of Thrones. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Anthony.
Anthony, as he has for many weeks now, is joining me as the co-author of Gods of Thrones, a book on the religions and cultures and the real world inspirations thereof, the Song of Ice and Fire, called Gods of Thrones. Welcome back, Anthony. We talked last year about Maegor, how he ruled for 6 years and 66 days, and how that has like some biblical significance of being an Antichrist number. And yes. I woke today to check our Amazon reviews, and we now have 66. So
we have 66 Amazon reviews.
Does that mean we're one short of the mark of the wild beast? Are we two thirds an Antichrist? What's the biblical significance of that?
Well, I wasn't going to mention this, but ironically, I sprouted horns this morning. I now have two horns protruding from my forehead that weren't there last night.
Well, you know, I checked some of the apocryphal prophecies, and they said that when the 66th review was sealed, that Lord Bezos would offer 10% off the list price for Gods of Thrones. And lo, it has occurred. The Amazon took us off sale some point over the weekend, but now we're back off 10% off list price. If you want a great Christmas present for a hard-to-please Game of Thrones fan, you want a guarantee it's got information that's entertaining, that they haven't seen or read or been exposed to before, I can recommend Gods of Thrones to you, Anthony Nye's new book, and you can get it 10% off right now. And Amazon is telling me that it will definitely ship in time for Christmas. So check that out. And don't take my word for it, because I'm going to read one of these recent reviews. Steve D., says, Aaron and Anthony provide a wonderful avenue to explore both the Game of Thrones television show and the corresponding novels, A Song of Ice and Fire. Gods of Thrones is funny, approachable, and a self-contained book that has all necessary information to understand the wide variety of life and culture represented in Martin's world. But, if you're like me, you'll want to use this book and its detailed collection of footnotes as a jumping-off point for much more. There are seemingly limitless depths in which you can dive deeper into the blurred line Martin created between his fictional world and reality of which we as Amazon consumers exist. Because of the Kickstarter, I feel lucky that I was able to observe the evolution of this project and the passion and energy it took to make a reality. But lastly, I wanted to apologize to Jeff Bezos, for I've robbed him of the opportunity to broker the transaction of this great work. And for my transgression, I've been cursed to never wear the blue checkered badge of verified purchaser again. So, I see multiple prophecies and transgressions, and I don't know if we're going to have a dance of Amazons coming up or what.
Is Jeff Bezos more like Good King Jaharis, or is he more like the cruel Maegor? What would you say, Aaron?
I want to see how the Bezos Musk war of 2025 works out.
That's a very prudent caution.
Yeah, thank you. I'm not sure if I'm a green man or a black man at this point. I think Bezos is the green because he's the copper lord, and we all know the copper turns green when it oxidizes. And Musk, of course, has taken the black ever since calling a heroic Australian or is a New Zealand diver a pedophile. I don't know.
I missed that. He's kind of gone off the deep end a little bit, hasn't he?
Maybe that's the true Maegor of the West. But we'll have to see. We'll be following these events very closely and with interest in the coming weeks ahead. Actually, we're going to be bringing our coverage to a close next week. In addition to Anthony joining me, I've also got my buddy Kim Renfro from The Insider and her excellent coverage of Game of Thrones. She's going to be joining to talk to me about this last section of Fire and Blood next week. I think Anthony and I will also have a bonus podcast on religion that comes out at some point after that, but our last official podcast on Gods of Thrones and Fire and Blood until next spring, where we welcome the release of our second volume of Gods of Thrones and as well as the return of Game of Thrones, the HBO series. So if you got feedback, now's the time to send it in to Game of Thrones at baldmove.com for consideration next week.
Oh, and before we begin, I want to do a little bit of housekeeping and let everybody, especially our club members, know our Christmas celebration here at Bald Move that we do annually is in full swing this year. It's themed a very Giamatti Christmas. We are doing reviews of all the Paul Giamatti Christmas movies. That's right, I said movies. He's in a few. We're also doing an original work of fan fiction called The One Man Manger, in which Paul Giamatti tries to greenlight a last-minute Christmas project. And Jim and I are going all out on that for club members. It's an 8-part miniseries. You can see the first 2 parts right now on baldmove.com. It's for club members only. And if you're not a club member and you've been sitting on the sidelines waiting for a reason to join, well, we're giving 25% off our annual subscriptions to the club. So if you go to baldmove.com, you can't miss it. There's a giant Giamatti dressed up as Santa Claus, and there's a join the club button. If you're not a club member, it'll take you to the special discount page. And if you are a club member, it will take you to a link that has all of our Christmas content. All right.
Let us talk about the second part. So we read from J. Harrison Allison's Triumphs and Tragedies to the close, or like this, the closing moments of the Dance with Dragons, the Dying of the Dragons, Rhaenyra's Triumphant. What did you think of this second third of the book, Anthony, just in general?
Sadly, it was a really difficult slog for most of the section. There were moments that were great and that I wouldn't want to miss. In fact, one of the most interesting moments in the whole book, I think, is in this section. Mm. Boy, there was just a lot of stuff I didn't care about right in the middle here.
Yeah, I thought the first two-thirds of this second third, if that makes any sense, were still pretty compelling. As I mentioned, J. Harris, I think, aside from maybe Aegon the Conqueror, which we already knew a lot about, J. Harris is kind of the standout hero and central figure of interest with his Queen Allison. And that's where, as he got older and he had some kind of missteps with his younger, because him and Queen Allison had like 11 children, and the 4 youngest gave them a lot of problems for one reason or another. And there's also a lot of death in the family. I felt like that Jaehaerys is kind of amalgam of the triumphs of like a Caesar Augustus, and that he, you know, found King's Landing brick and he left it marble. And that there's lots of talks about him improving the city and widening its streets and bringing in, like, building great aqueducts that bring fresh water into the city. And he built the majority of the famous roads, like the King's Road, that kind of stitched the land together. But also there's a lot of kind of like the last czar of Russia, in that there's this young king and queen who loved each other very much and had lots of had children, but so much death in the family, as was common, you know, right. Until we get to the modern age. Yeah, we talked about how, you know, you had this this good king, Jaehaerys, who reigned for over 50 years, and, you know, everyone talked about him being the good king and how his reign was one long summer, and how do you make something like that interesting? Well, you make that interesting by just filling it with a bunch of, death and betrayals. And the earlier ones, it seems like the king kind of bears fairly lightly because, when he gets in minor wars, he's able to distinguish himself, and everything kind of works out all to the better. The Sea Lord steals 3 dragon eggs, but he's able to wrest a concession from Braavos to where they forgive all the crown's debt. So, like, even the setbacks turn out to be, you know, boons for the king. But that,
I guess, the problem with this is that death is an important part of the narrative. But there are just so few characters in this story that I feel empathy for.
Right.
Not necessarily like I just don't care if they live or die, but there just hasn't been enough character development for a number of these people who they may be on the page for 50 or so pages, but I have not traveled with them in the same way that I traveled with Arya or Tyrion or someone like that, where I would be shocked and dismayed by their day. It's just not that kind of book.
And that's the thing, because I really liked his two oldest sons, Balon and Aegon, and you know, he was grooming these guys, but then, you know, like so much of the rest of the royal family, they end up dying. But unfortunately, George had spent a lot of time developing these characters, so you know, the people that then take the story from this point are much less sketched out. And also, right. George, you know, with 11 children, I felt like he started doing a lot where just very thinly sketching these kids. Like, this child was lusty and he sucked his wet nurse dry, but this child was timid. And then this other one was lusty and had like, everything was, you know, the Targaryens were these gregarious man and women children, kind of like out of the mold of Bobby B, or they were right. like these kind of sickly, reserved people that you either send to the Citadel or you send to the Starry Sept to be Septas. And like Jaehaerys and Allison, we met them as like preteens and mm-hmm. saw their love story and, you know, was rooting for them. These young king and queen that kind of brashly took the throne and started taking charge. And, you know, like the book, once we get past the reign of Jaehaerys, I felt like kind of really struggled. And I felt like even George himself was kind of yada-yadding through. Jaehaerys' son, Viserys, reigned for 26 years, but he got like 15-20 pages, you know? There was just like the same shit that George, I think, was afraid of with Jaehaerys. We got in full measure with that. And then, you know, that his family then begat the Dance of Dragons, and George clearly wanted to tell that story. But I was annoyed with the framework because, you know, essentially he had to tell like a history of a maester, a history of the Septon, the High Septon, and then the history of this mushroom who was the fool for this royal family.
Mushroom has some interesting takes on this particular history.
But it got so predictable to where he would give the reliable history, but then he'd spend a page and a half in Mushroom's fantasies, where it's essentially like whatever sexual perversion and violence that is the kind of stock and trade of Game of Thrones is turned up to like 11. And then, but yet every once in a while, the High Septon would be like, "Methinks Mushroom has the right of it," when Mushroom's biases and bullshit would line up with the maester who's collating this history. Which,
well,
is that,
and it is really
realistic?
Predictable. It's predictable in that it's like there's some peace treaty that's being brokered,
uh-huh.
and so we'll get the bare bones sketches of it, and then Mushroom will interject and say, "Of course." And then there was a night of passion that followed.
Right.
There was, you know, this and that debauchery. But of mm-hmm. course, and then we get sort of like, but of course, Mushroom would say that because Mushroom is Mushroom. And I'm
right.
thinking, well, if he's that predictable, why do we need that every single time?
Yeah, I was wrestling. I was like, is this like some kind of sop to? Because I haven't read a lot of first person accounts of ancient history, and I was wondering, like, you know, if you get into like Tacitus or Herodotus, or do they do this kind of thing where it's like, well, here's the reliable stuff, and here's what the people think, and oh, here's this crazy take because they're trying to move copies in the ancient world.
Well,
and
here's what tends to happen. Actually, it's not many people are writing history as we know it in the ancient world.
That's true.
But every now and again, you will get someone who is, you know, he's an elite academic, and he is writing basically to impress somebody. So he's writing a history because he's friends with Caesar, or he's friends with this particular lord or lady or something like that, and he wants them to come off really well in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you end up getting is you don't get the kind of mushroom stories of debauchery. Now, you will get those with fiction. Sometimes you'll get those with accounts of fiction. And, you know, you've got erotica in the Greek literature and the Roman literature. But as far as history is concerned, you don't have someone like Mushroom, because at the end of the day, you want this to be read either by or to your royal buddies, and you want them to pat you on the back and you know, keep them in your court. What you will see from time to time is you'll see, okay, so now Caligula's dead, and we can really say what, you know, we can tell every rumor about Caligula there is.
Right, we're
backed
up.
Because everyone hated him anyway, and the new Caesar is, you know, he realizes that his uncle was a total tool anyway. So sometimes you'll get that. You know, the mushrooms coming off as, look, I was sort of in the guise of a fool in their court, and I got to hear everything, and they didn't know that I was writing this all down, and so now I'm going to tell you, Drew, what really happened. Yeah, there's nothing like that. I can't think of any analog, at least in the parts of ancient history that I've studied.
So we talked about kind of it being a mixed bag. I'm actually kind of fearful for the next section because I thought that maybe we would get into something. I knew this is the second. There's a volume one, volume two. I thought we might be able to get into Baylor the Blessed's rule, which is kind of, I always considered an analog to kind of an Emperor Constantine type. Where he's like all in on the faith of the seven, you know, he becomes known as Baylor the Blessed, and that. But no, we're going to end like right in the middle of these what I consider less noteworthy Targaryens, and I'm very curious to see these next 200 some pages whether how George is going to keep our attention when. Because, like I said, in between Jaehaerys and the dance, like there's so much yada yadaing, and I thought the dance itself wasn't that super compelling, which is crazy when you think about how much dragon on dragon combat there was. Maybe we can get into the stuff we actually wanted to talk about. I don't want to belabor these points too much.
Hey, can I ask you a quick question related to kind of the the very skeletal portrait we're getting, it's almost like we're getting a portrait of so many children who are described in two or three words, like
lusty, like, and tip drying.
this one was timid, this one was bookish, this one was a warrior. So if you're going to reduce a character to that level of superficiality, I guess it's inevitable that you're going to fall into some typical male and female stereotypes. And I'm wondering if you were bothered by this at all. It seems like every woman was either attractive or not attractive. Yep. Every woman was either able to give able to give an heir or not.
Yeah.
Or rebellious, or, you know, good natured or whatever. And I started to get a little bit weary of the stereotypes, but I can be oversensitive when it comes to those sorts of things. What do you think?
Yes, you're accurately trying to portray a medieval world that has all these superstitions and sexism, but what is an author's obligation to kind of like buck that and show that, like, you know, in the world, the good people actually are, you know, far more enlightened than you'd expect. And I think they have, like, you know, Queen Alison, who, for the good two-thirds of Jaehaerys' reign, is essentially a co-ruler with him.
Right. And she's a complex character, especially when she starts dealing with her children. There's no doubt about that. It just feels like I've met about 100 female characters in this book.
Right.
And I know, and I can tell you to a person which one of them is well endowed and which is not.
Right,
I just feels like, come on.
I don't know, because, like, certainly there's Martin Lampshade's that, because one of the first real blowouts that Jaehaerys and Queen Alison had was over the fact that Jaehaerys reflexively skipped over his eldest daughter as a suitable heir to the throne. And, like, oh, well, it's going to be fine, because obviously this guy's going to marry his daughter anyway, just like us, and it'll be fine. But, like, the queen's like, and then this comes to a head later on when his heir dies, and he still is unwilling to name a perfectly fine eldest daughter as his heir, and instead calls a great council.
And it could be that he's doing his best to adopt a medieval sexist perspective in writing this particular history, because it's supposed to come from Maestons, Septons, and Fools, right? It's not supposed to come from some modern woke author. But at the same time, you do it, man, I feel like it's repetitive. It's getting repetitive.
I do wonder, though, just for real, like, if Martin would have been better suited to make this the Maester telling the story. Like, this is kind of like a revisionist Maester who's more of a radical, and like, you know, the way Marwyn doesn't give a fuck about what the other Maesters think about his research into magic, he's doing it as because he thinks it's right, and he's like, make this guy be a little bit more like shockingly modern in his commentary. And less staid and stodgy and, like, you know, official history. Like, I think it would have flattered. I think he would have been able to make more of his points and tell something that lines more with his personal politics if he'd gone that way. But he didn't. He chose a point of view of a very conservative, stodgy, prudish Maester.
All right. Hey, he's got at least one really compelling female character, and she's great. She's Alysanne Targaryen. And I hope that they at least make one HBO spinoff about her, because she's really interesting.
Honestly, and I would love to see The Reign of Jaehaerys as a series. It would be pretty. It'd be a bummer because, you know, I don't know what point in his history that you would like say, "Yep, this is the happy ending," and we won't tell any tales of the woe that befall him. But boy, that first 25 years or so, he has a really good run.
Or do it with a like sort of a conscious effort to tell the fans, this is loosely based on, you know, a character like Jaehaerys. So we don't necessarily know the outcome, because I always feel like, you know, that's always a point of contention. But anyway, I think that Alysanne's little trip up north is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And to kind of set the stage for this, so Jaehaerys and Alysanne are they're sort of in the early stages of the Golden Age.
Mm-hmm.
And they're flying their dragons all over the place trying to make peace.
They're doing their progressions through the realm.
That's right. And Alysanne decides, well, Jaehaerys is off making peace, and he's going to be half a year. I think he's in Essos or King's Landing or something. She says, I'm just going to go up to Winterfell. She's at Winterfell, and she decides, well, if I'm here and my husband's not going to be arriving anytime soon, I think I'm going to go even further north, and she goes to the Wall. Mm-hmm. And this is if you read sort of some of the promotional material for the book, you'll be familiar with this passage. But I thought it was really fascinating. I'll just read this one paragraph. So she's talking about her dragon named Silverwing. Thrice I flew Silverwing high above Castle Black, and thrice I tried to take her north beyond the Wall, Alysanne wrote to Jaehaerys. But every time she veered back south again and refused to go. Never before has she refused to take me where I wished to go. I laughed about it when I came down again so that the Black Brothers would not realize anything was amiss. But it troubled me then, and it troubles me still. And immediately when I read that, I thought, aha, I think this is maybe not a fan theory that you came up with, but it's one that you've mentioned a few times, Aaron. The Wall is not just keeping the White Walkers from coming south, that the Wall may actually be there to also keep dragons from going north.
There's a few theories that really got me when I read, you know, when I first started exploring the fan community after I'd watched the first few seasons and read all the books. And one of the ones that really I thought I was attracted to was this theory that, you know, there's this ancient pact between the First Men and probably the Children of the Forest and the White Walkers because, you know, the White Walkers are great villains, but they're not George Martin villains. Because George Martin always says that, like, you know, he disliked the fact that there's, like, this dedicated race in Tolkien, the orcs. And they're just all evil. There's not a lighthearted orc. There's not a orc that wants to be a bard. There's not an orc that just wants to retire and be an innkeeper somewhere. They're just all right. Bloody-minded assholes. And yet Martin has this race of ice monsters who appear to be just a race of bloody-minded assholes. And I thought it would be there's some hints in the ancient, you know, Age of Heroes material that we have in the world of Ice and Fire and Tales of Old Nan that there might be a little bit more mixing. Like there's this tale of this 13th Lord Commander that fell in love with a White Walker lady and had half White Walker, half human children with her. And there's this hints that there's more to it. And one of the theories that come out of there, we talk at length about in volume one of our Gods of Thrones books, is the possibility that this wall is like a DMZ, a demilitarized zone, that's like, okay, we're going to be up north and you be south, and we're going to respect each other's boundaries. And, you know, just like the First Men and the Children concluded a covenant that was forgotten thousands and thousands of years ago, that the First Men and the White Walkers have concluded a similar covenant. And that it's interesting that these beasts of fire, like, instinctively know not to cross that line.
Or that they can't.
There's also another possibility that just dragons don't like cold, because we're about to talk about another account here of dragon-like creatures succumbing to cold, because in the pair, in the passage immediately before she tries to get him to cross the wall and he doesn't, they talk about Silverwing, I think is the name of the dragon, that anytime a cold wind would gust over the wall, that he would hiss and snap at it. Like, and the dragon was just visibly uncomfortable being that far north. It could just be that dragon's cold. And, you know, this there's this cold wind blowing from the north that the dragon doesn't like. But I think that obviously Martin's trying to hint that there's something more. This is a flashing red, roop, roop, pay attention for your theory crafting kind of thing.
Right. And he did release this particular chapter ahead of time.
Right. Because he knew
probably
it'd be
of interest. Knowing that he'd get a little bit of discussion going about it.
So let's talk about the other thing I want to talk about. That we left last week's discussion with the mystery of Princess Arya and her mounting this 13-year-old princess, a headstrong princess, mounting the Black Dread Balerion and taking him off to parts unknown. And the first little bit of this section deals with the king trying to investigate this mystery that, you know, there's these unexplained wildfires in Essos. There's a section of the Essos where if men go there, they never come back, and they're trying to investigate where Balerion has gone to, and there's all their examinations come up empty, or they're explained by something else. And then one day Balerion comes flying back to King's Landing and drops off a dying Princess Arya. And she dies within days of returning to King's Landing. And
yeah, she looks like she's been starved, and she's wearing ragged clothes.
She's burning with fever.
She can barely speak, but what she does say is, please kill me, please kill me, please kill
right.
me.
Right, she begs for death. So we've got the Septon and the Maester's like private journals talking about, because the official story is she came back with a fever, died some days later, and then the realm mourned for her and everything moved on. But they talked about her description being like flesh cooked within, her skin was cracked and blackened, that... Then when they tried dipping her into an ice bath, that her body exploded with these worms that came out of her. And there's always these like these unholy shapes are kind of writhing within her belly. And they were described as worms with faces or snakes with hands.
Yeah, I'll read this little section here. The things, mother have mercy. I don't know how to speak of them. They were worms with faces, snakes with hands, twisting, slimy, unspeakable things that seemed to rise and pulse and squirm, and they came bursting from her flesh. Some were no bigger than my little finger, but one at least was as long as my arm. Oh, warrior, protect me. The sounds they made.
Yeah, so there's a lot, you know, this book's been out for a couple of weeks and people are trying to look into this. There's, you know, a lot of the passages in the world of Ice and Fire talking about the Valerians getting really freaky with their experimentation, especially, you know, with the because they were a slave empire. They experimented with their slaves and did all kinds of cross animal and human breeding and trying to make, and even in this book, Septon, what's his name? Septon Bart.
Yeah.
He talks about how the Valerians were known to make these chimera type creations, and he suspects that these are the remnants of, like, you know, because his theory is Arya didn't take Balerion anywhere. This girl jumped on Balerion's back and he just took her wherever the hell he wanted to. And Balerion is the only dragon left alive that remembers old Valerian, because Balerion's old. Or old Valerian. Right, he's like almost 300 years old before he dies. So he remembers pre-doom Valeria, and he wanted to return to his ancestral homeland and took this girl, and she got infected with these abominations that the Valerians had cooked up. And
He's got this great line where he says, "We've been asking the wrong question. We've been asking all this time, where did Arya take Balerion? What we should have been asking is where Balerion took Arya."
Right.
And he surmises, and this is just his guess.
Yes.
That they go to old Valyria.
And then what's really disturbing to him is that, is the note that Balerion himself had some pretty serious wounds. He had like 9-foot gashes on his side where something with fangs or teeth had wounded him. And they're like, you know, what the hell is going on in old Valyria? And you know, other than just like, oh, well, maybe there's these things called bloodworms that have been discussed, you know, mentioned kind of in the same breath as snarks and grumpkins, that maybe these are hints of these bloodworms. Maybe there's still some feral dragons in old Valyria, that a lot of people are surmising that there's an analogous situation between what Dany's doing with Drogon and what Arya did with Balerion, where, you know, Dany jumps on Drogon's back in the slave pits of Meereen and flies off and takes Dany out into the wilderness, and Dany is suffering. She's actually sick with the Pale Mare, apparently, at the end of this. And you know, obviously the show takes her in a completely different direction, but some people are wondering whether Drogon is going to perhaps take Dany to old Valyria to discover some secret that's going to be vital to the final disposition of the Song of Ice and Fire.
It's interesting. I was just giving a lecture at the University of Dayton here a couple weeks ago, and I was going through these ancient, they were kind of meant, they're called bestiaries, and they were kind of meant as natural history encyclopedias before people really understood the natural world. So they're more theological than anything else. But one of the things that I sort of highlighted in these books is that all of the monsters that the ancient mind really believes that these exist, but most of the monsters that they come up with are hybrid creatures.
Right.
So you got a cross between a lion and a man, or a cross between two different animals. And the belief is that there are people out there, witches or whomever, who are experimenting, and they're taking these different seeds and merging them together to create these abominations.
Right.
So it's interesting that this is what comes out, these hybrid creatures bursting out of her womb, I suppose.
Martin goes there. He makes sure that we know that there's smoke coming from both sets of this princess's lips.
Yep. That's right. And she's it's not just that she has a fever. You can't even touch her. She's burning, you know, she's burning through someone's armor. So they can feel her heat.
Right.
The other thing I was curious about this is that back when I forget which book this is, but one of the faceless men, it may be Jack and Hagar, I'm not sure. He's explaining the history of the faceless men, and that they were once, they descend from a people that were once slaves in the mines of Valyria. And he mentions these things called fireworms that really, really hate humans.
Right.
And so I there was part of me that wondered, like, oh, she's hot, and she's got these worm-like creatures. And there is sort of a conjecture here that she's gone to Valeria. So maybe these are the fireworms. I'm not sure what to do with that information.
Yeah, that's what I said bloodworms. I meant to say fireworms. Yeah. And also, like, correspondingly, there's this Victarion character who is, you know, brother of Euron Greyjoy. And he is sent by Euron to go essentially fetch Daenerys to be his wife. And on the way over there, he gets this wound on his arm that festers, and this red priest heals him, but his hand is left smoking and cracked and burnt looking. And there's some theory crafting in the last week or two that suggests that maybe Victarion's been infected with these fireworms. With some kind of magic from the red priest that is healing him and making him stronger or something like that. So because the descriptions of what this thing's doing to their flesh is almost identical.
Okay, and I think now that you say that, because I wasn't familiar with that theory, but now that you say that, I feel like I ought to correct myself. The text doesn't actually say they came from bursting forth from her womb. It just says from her flesh.
Right.
So it could be that, you know, these worms were all throughout her body or something like that.
Well, the final theory that I've been saving is that there is a suggestion that the Valerians themselves are an actual human-dragon hybrid. Because there is something special about their blood, in so much as that every dragon rider that we know of thus far has had, has been a Valerian or a Targaryen or Targaryen bastard. So at least, you know, of mixed blood, and you know the if Valerians are doing these hybrids, that it's possible that they did some genetic engineering using these fireworms to produce the line of dragon riders, these lords that could actually, you know, commune with the dragons in some way, and the dragons would recognize as kin, and that the fireworms were somehow either byproducts or mistakes or, you know, like a catalyst to get this transformation. So that would imply that the Valerians actually are special in some way.
Yeah, I mean, I can totally see that being the case. I'm always a little bit cautious about this, mm-hmm. and I think you know my feelings about the sort of the dual ethics of ruling class versus commoner sort of thing. Mm-hmm. He's just bigger and better and wiser, and he's meant to rule where commoners are not meant to rule. Yeah. It's a myth that has created all kinds of misery in our own history.
There's a couple other things I want to talk about, because, like, I found that the Dance of Dragons was not as exciting as I was hoping for, because it's right. like a modern Hollywood blockbuster movie where there's dragons fighting. I thought an obvious is a kind of a humane war, and that the Targaryens essentially fought more Targaryen on Targaryen than anything. Like, you know, instead of having tens of thousands of men fighting and dying as you know, the dragons are fighting overhead, it's just essentially dragon on dragon combat.
There's a lot of intrigue, like assassins. Mm-hmm. There's one scene where assassins break into the queen's room and say, "Okay, tell me which one of your sons I should kill." And she says, "Just kill me." And they're like, "Nope, it's a son for a son. You know, your enemy lost a son. Now you're going to have to lose a son." And so she chooses the younger of the two.
The two-year-old.
And she says, kill him. What they do is they kill the older one and whisper into the two-year-old's ear, "Your mama wanted you dead." And then they
right.
leave with
right.
the head of the older boy. So, you know, it's tame in that we don't have the carnage of the battlefield.
Right.
But that's pretty dark.
And you got this fucking mushroom where every single account you have to, after they tell us what actually happened, you then get the, you know, a Cinemax after hours version of it from the point of view of Mushroom. But the core problem is, like I said, like a Hollywood blockbuster, lots of cool action, and these fight scenes go on for a very long time, but I didn't really care about any of the characters that were doing it.
Yeah.
And so, right. like, whatever. There's an interesting bit about identical twin Kingsguards that found themselves on opposite ends of the battlefield, that they're the taming of the wild dragons is kind of interesting. There's a side note about a clutch of dragon eggs that one of the dragons laid in the crypts of Winterfell.
Yeah. And well, that was one of Mushroom's rumors, right?
It's one of Mushroom's rumors, but the interesting thing is, like, there's been a long time speculation that there is a dragon that lies beneath Winterfell. And because, you know, Winterfell famously has these geothermal vents, that is one of the reasons it's a stronghold of the North, is that it stays warm even in the coldest of the winters. And a lot of people think, you know, the old folklore says that there is a dragon that sleeps in the bowels of Winterfell, and his breath is what warms the earth. But if this is the one instance that Mushroom's got the right of it, and there are a clutch of eggs deep within the bowels of the necropolis of the crypts of Winterfell, and it's warmed by a geothermal vent, then it's possible these dragon eggs might hatch and be a part of the story going forward.
Or it's one of these instances where the rumor is too good not to play with.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, we've got lots of mythologies that are basically built out of, I mean, every volcano god. You just look at every volcano god in every culture, and there's basically, this is a mythology that rose out of the sheer massive power of a volcano. You need to have some story to explain how it got there and what our relationship to it
you
is.
You have to, yeah. If you don't have the scientific method, you worship it. Absolutely.
Right. But there's a current, you know, there's sort of a there's a little kernel of truth to these bits of mythology, and maybe that's what's going on here. Like, yeah, they don't. There's no dragon that's sleeping under Winterfell, but there may be a kernel of truth to the rumor, you know.
Well, so this also brings me to a thing that was mentioned all throughout this book. I thought that hatching a dragon required some kind of human sacrifice, and that's something that
I'm so glad you brought it up, and I feel like I need to sort of backtrack. It was pretty suspicious the way that George answered his question, because he got asked directly, does there need to be a human sacrifice in order to hatch a dragon? And he was sort of like, well, there are clues in the book, but I don't think I want to answer that. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a pretty telling non-answer. Mm-hmm. But I'm reading through this book, and there's just dragons and dragons and dragons and dragons. And I could probably go back and count the number of, like, funeral pyres,
mm-hmm.
and try to connect it to see, I wonder if, okay, so this guy was ritually on a funeral pyre, and then we see the birth of this clutch of dragons. But I think more and more, I probably need to walk this one back. There's just too many dragons.
But, because, like, I wish I had the time, and I don't, because I barely have the time to read the 230 pages I have to each week with all my other stuff I'm doing. But
yeah.
I had an inkling of, like, well, what if Anthony's right? Because there is a lot of Targaryen death, like mysterious, like ill-fated death. And I would love to count the number of times where they mention a king puts a dragon egg in their baby's crib to hatch, so they're like, you know, there'll be a bonded hatchling and dragon rider, and then a corresponding sudden Targaryen death, because it would be interesting that if the Targaryens were paying the iron price for their dragon eggs the whole time and just didn't know it, like they think that this family is just covered in tragedy. And the most prolific time of the dragons, when Queen Allison and Jaehaerys were punching out babies like movie tickets and the dragons were breeding, brought about the Dance of the Dragons, where you had a corresponding number of Targaryens killed and dragons dying. And I don't know if you can get in the back of us out and be like, okay, dragon egg hatch, whoop, Targaryen dead, boom. Like, but I think there's enough maybe wiggle room there that someone could say that there is some sort of life force that has to be paid there. I don't know. So we leave this section of the book where the dance is kind of like at a temporary moment of victory for the black side of the Targaryens. That is the women heirs. The Queen Rhaenyra is sitting on the throne, and there's a whole procession of people doing obeisance to her and pledging support. She sits on the throne all day and all night, taking pledges of loyalty. But when she gets up, all the court notices that she suffered several cuts to her legs and arms as she sat on the Iron Throne. And the rumor is that it soon will reject her. And I'm presuming that the dance is going to rage on. And honestly, I don't know what's going to happen in the next 230-some pages, because I feel like all of the good stuff from this era of Targaryens is past, and you know, we're a long ways off from Baelor the Blessed or the Blackfyre Rebellions or the things that kind of launched the modern era of Targaryen history. I mean, and it seems like now it's just going to be, now's the time of the stunting of the dragons and all that. So.
Well, yeah, that's true. I am going to be looking for little Easter eggs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that will help me understand some of the plot right. points of the novels. I will be looking to see what are the hints that this particular narrator tells us about how the dragons come to be diminished.
Right.
Because that may or may not feed into that sort of the maesters are killing the dragons theory. So there are little things like that I'm still looking for. And, you know, I give Martin the benefit of the doubt. You know, even in this particular section where there were, you know, a good 10 pages at a time that were really dull, that 11th page was worth it, you know?
Shall we get the feedback now?
Yeah, let's go.
All right, feedback. You can send feedback to Game of Thrones at baldmove.com, or we also have weekly discussion threads for Fire and Blood and Game of Gods and Thrones on our forums.baldmove.com. First up, Jordan N., do you guys have any theories as to why the Targaryens seem to have a pretty high rate of miscarriages and stillbirths? Also, why they're more often described as monstrous rather than humans, with wings and scales and twisted limbs? They're described several times in graphic detail, which makes me think it's somehow significant. So let's take this part first. I have a theory, Anthony. What's yours?
Well, I don't have a theory, but I will point out that in the pre-modern period, the infant mortality was really high, and it was less high if you were royal and you had all of the, you know, the amenities and the maesters and
good diets and yeah.
But you know it's at certain points in history about one in five women would die in childbirth. So mm-hmm. I mean that's an enormous rate. I guess I would challenge the premise that the Targaryens have a high infant mortality rate. It could just be that Martin is being faithful to the medieval problem of childbirth, but that's not as interesting as whatever theory you're going to come up with next.
Incest. It's a bad idea. It leads to birth defects and miscarriages and all kinds of tragic things. So
and fireworms.
Yeah, and fireworms. So all what you said is true as well. Moving on to his additional point, Jordan continues, additionally, is the frequency of Targaryen deformities another piece of evidence that Tyrion is a Targaryen? The physical descriptions of him have some similarities to descriptions of some of the miscarried babies with his twisted limbs and misshapen characteristics. We don't encounter many Westerosi dwarves. The ones we have been introduced to mainly seem to come from Essos. Maybe in Martin's universe, the genetic possibility of dwarfism is something that's only shared by people of Essos, which would rule out Tyrion being the fruit of Tywin's loins. In the books, for sure, there's a lot more dwarfs. There's just so many that get killed in Cersei's mad quest to find her brother, because she just essentially right. pays for dwarf heads to be brought to her. I don't know about that, but there's certainly no shortage of theories suggesting that Tyrion is a half Targaryen or secret Targaryen. And in fact, we in both of our books, we end up considering potential parallels there.
Yeah, no, yeah. Tyrion is one of our favorite characters, period, but also there's some fun foreshadowing that happens with Tyrion, and yeah, you know, he's it's fun to imagine him as a secret Targaryen. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, and like, you know, that would potentially give him a potential to ride a dragon, which would be. You know, I talk about Varys, like the smallest man can cast a large shadow. If you put the smallest man on a giant dragon, he casts a pretty damn big shadow. So I always thought that would be cool. I don't think it's a possibility in the show, but it's very much a possibility in the books.
And we should mention that Mushroom, who we're both tired of hearing, Mushroom is actually a little person as well.
He is. Yeah, he is.
He also claims to have a schlong three times the size of the king.
Right, right, right. And a cunning and penetrating intellect as well to go along with it. Which very much, well, it's funny because like, I think there's a line that much of the royal family assumed he was a lackwit, which is why they were so free to talk in front of him. And then why after they're all long gone and buried, he was able to just do this devastating tell all of the royal family. So
right. And then eventually he's got this line that says, eventually, they all started taking counsel from me.
Right.
I was the invisible king in Motley.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he kind of fancies himself as sort of the puppeteer behind the Dance of Dragons.
Robert H. said, I know you and Jim said this during season 7, but this book confirms how much I disdain Jon Snow's real name being Aegon. There have been so many goddamned Aegons in the book, and I still have over 300 pages to go. I get why it's such a popular name, but I feel like because Jon is the prince who was promised, his name should be more unique. Jaehaerys makes so much more sense, in my opinion, and I feel like there are some similarities between the two of them. What Targaryen do you guys fits Jon the best? I mean, I went on record saying that Aemon was the layup there. He was Jon's mentor just as much as the old bear was at the wall. And I like that. I like that name. I thought that would have been a nice, people would be like, oh yeah, instead of like Aegon the Sixth or whatever. Like, that's my opinion. What do you think, Anthony?
I don't care. I'm sorry.
You're over the Targaryens.
I can't really get too much heat behind this. I'm gonna call him John. I'll probably call him Jon Snow. Long after it's kosher to call him Jon Snow. Mm-hmm. So that's just my bent.
Yeah. No. I like King Snow as well. That's something interesting about that. One more piece of feedback. He said that the way George described these Targaryen brothers and sisters is so similar to Jaime and Cersei. Are there any other examples of brothers and sisters falling in love in the world of ice and fire? I really wonder if George has been laying breadcrumbs that they're both secret Targaryens and Tyrion is the red herring. So he's of the, cause there is no shortage of, there is no shortage of rumors that, or theories that Jaime and Cersei are the real secret Lannisters, and Tyrion is just something that George put there to throw us off the scent. I'm a bad person to ask that because I don't think those theories have a lot of weight. And also, I can't out of the Targaryens and Jaime and Cersei, I'm struggling to think of any brother-sister incest in the world of Ice and Fire. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, do we need more? I don't think we need any more. But I wanted to ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
There's this character, Sarah.
Right.
And she, you know, she's a kind of a wild child, and she ends up escaping. She's the son of the king and queen. And she ends up escaping to Essos, and becomes a prostitute in Essos.
Mm-hmm.
And the speculation is that she probably is making pretty good money because people are paying, knowing that they're having sex for a night with a Targaryen princess. And that immediately made me think of Brown Ben Plum.
Mm.
So Brown Ben Plum is in the books, but not in the movies. And there's this throwaway line, or maybe it's a paragraph in the books that say that he's got a drop of Targaryen blood in him.
Right,
and he claims that it was under one of the Aegons that his mother was a dragon seed or something like that, And but he can't remember which Aegon it was, and so he's not really clear on it. And I immediately thought, oh, maybe George is trying to explain why Brown Ben Plum has a drop of Targaryen blood in his veins.
Well, you know, that's another interesting thing, because, like, there's so much potential Targaryen blood in Essos at this point that it gets, you know, it kind of gives fuel to a lot of these, you know, is Varys a secret Targaryen? Is Illyrio a secret Targaryen? Is he a Blackfyre Targaryen? Or there were, like, they're, my God, yeah, there's, like, maybe it's, like, a one of those situations like Genghis Khan where, you know, fully half of the population of Essos now could conceivably ride a dragon. Because of poor Sarah and her exile to Essos.
Hey, do you think, all right, very general question. Everyone likes the idea of their favorite character being a secret Targaryen. Do you think that there will be at least one more reveal of a secret Targaryen in Martin's world?
In the show or in the books? Absolutely. Absolutely. I wouldn't be surprised if there were several. But really? I mean, and also since the book has yet to reveal Jon Snow as a secret Targaryen, I mean, I could cheat and say I'm absolutely going to be correct in that there'll be one more revealed. But yeah, no, I like 80% sure on that one.
Wow. Okay. Some pretty big matzo balls you're putting out there, man.
Yeah, and every time I see, like, you know, there's a Targaryen princess. She was one of the lusty ones that her cries echoed through the Red Keep when she was pleasured by her king or whatever. She had mismatched eyes and crooked features, and you know, like, and also like the weird, like, because a lot of people, well, Tyrion's hair is not exactly the platinum that's supposed to be, but neither was hers, and she was a pure blooded Targaryen. There's just a lot of these details that Martin's put in there, and why else would he do it with the full knowledge of what he's written before, unless he's trying to hint there.
Well, I think that we both agree that something significant will be revealed about Tyrion. I think that there's enough foreshadowing to say in those general terms that Tyrion there's something in store for Tyrion that isn't on the surface of things.
Let's move on to Brandon W. So he says, from what I've gotten from the first six books in a sixth and very weak seventh season of the show is that the House Castamere was an old and possibly great house, almost equal to that of House Lannister. With that being said, why do you think Gurm makes absolutely no reference to Castamere as of my two-thirds way through Fire and Blood? Has he simply just forgot that they existed, or should we assume that they were in reality such a minor house that they played almost no role? Just pondering. So I'm actually somewhat shocked that Lannisters have played very minor roles in what's going on in Fire and Blood so far.
It's true.
It's been...
And every indication is that they are the lords of Casterly Rock, and he's right that... We've heard nothing about the reigns of Castamere.
But also, like, I was thinking that, you know, the House Bolton, huge, prominent, great house in the North, I don't think I've seen the Boltons mentioned once.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
It's more, you know, and of course the Starks kind of are somewhat remote and removed. You know, there's even a lot, before the King's Road is completed, there's a lot of contemplation about, well, whose side is Stark going to be on? And like, oh, LOL, no one cares by the time he gets his shit to one side or the war or the other. It'll be over. But I think that it seems like there's a lot more about the Riverlands. It's a lot more about Dorne. There's a lot more about, obviously, the Tyrells. This is very Southron, and the Westerlands and the North are kind of erased from the history at large. I mean, they definitely, there's Lannisters mentioned and Starks mentioned and all that, but I think it'd be a mistake to say that and especially since the reigns, they kind of up jumped during the reign of Tywin's father, who is kind of a more weak, less effective ruler. It's not like they were always this great house. It's just that they were able to profit from the Lannisters' mismanagement, and then Tywin set them to straight the rights.
So if we're looking for maybe an in-world answer to this question, I'm thinking about this. There's this little passage in Dance of Dragons, the book, where Jaime is off beyond the Riverlands. I forget exactly where he's at, but he's not too far. You know, he's within a couple of hours of where he grew up, and he's talking to a couple commoners about this ancient feud between these two houses mm-hmm. that he's really never heard of before. And he's getting the whole history of how this goes way, way back, even before the Targaryens arrived. And so it just goes to show you that if you're going to do sort of a family-centric history, which is what this is Targaryen-centric history, there's a lot of these little feuds and houses and whatnot that you'll never hear about.
Oh, right, yeah. And even there's even like some startling things that like before the Westeros was the Seven Kingdoms, it was the Ten Kingdoms, and in the Age of Heroes it was the 99 Kingdoms, but
right, right.
there were sometimes sure. as many as 132 and as few as 80. So it's like you get the idea that you know it's
always it's, shifting.
It's always shifting, and houses rise and fall in prominence, and you know Aegon was a huge there was two great houses that essentially went extinct, maybe three, and were displaced by others. Like, that's how the Tullys became Lords of the Riverlands before it was ruled by the Iron Islanders. And that's how, you know, so that's how Greyjoys became, that's how the Tullys became a great house. That's how the Tyrells, who were the Stuarts of the Gardeners, became a prominent house. They were not even noble houses before the Targaryens came along. So, well, I guess the Tullys were. But let's move on to Stephen S. I said, glad I wasn't alone and wanting some help on who the F each of these Targaryens belongs to. I feel like I had a good handle on things through the reign of Jaehaerys the First, but it gets dodgy after that. Amen. Amen, brother. Mayhaps I have not been more confused in my 5 and 30 years. I couldn't locate a good family tree for those inbred goofballs post Fire and Blood's release. If you have seen one, would you mind linking it in the next show notes? Well, it's funny because, like, I noticed that the Wiki of Ice and Fire, which is kind of like the Bible for these things, has got a moratorium on Fire and Blood updates until December 20th. So a lot of these clarifications are not in there. But in the back of the book itself, there's a list of the Targaryen successions and a Targaryen lineage that goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8... at least 8 generations of Targaryens, at least through the end of this book I'm holding. So I don't know if the Kindle version doesn't have that, but at the very end of the book, there's a lineage chart that's pretty detailed.
If there's one thing I can guarantee you is that there will be a Targaryen family tree that someone in the world puts on the internet. So it's just a matter of time before that exists.
Oh yeah, no, and they're gonna like I'm sure there's people that have already got these things composed in their Google Docs. The second that midnight strikes on December 20th, the Wiki of Ice and Fire will be overran by Targaryen loyalists that are setting the records right. Purging the blasphemes of Mushroom and replacing it with the true and accurate account of Maester Martin, or whatever his pen name is here. All right. Yeah. Last email, and this goes into a lot more thematic stuff we've been talking in the last few weeks, Anthony, from Lenny C. What are the religious implications of the birth of dragons, and what is the relationship between magic, religion, and dragons? Can you talk about the impact the birth of dragons and the comet have had on the increase in magic, specifically with the warlock's powers and the alchemist guild's claim of improved wildfire? She has a lot of questions about this. She wants to talk about the religion and magic impacting the White Walkers, and maybe this is a corresponding increase in power of the Night's King that is a corresponding increase that we've seen with the Melisandre and the Pyromancers, etc.
Right.
And also, like, if the warging of the Stark Children is corresponds to this awakening of magic. So I thought maybe we could talk about these things in particular, and maybe the concept of magic versus religion to an ancient mind.
Yeah. This is really a really great question. Who asked it again?
Lenny C.
Okay. Lenny. Lenny. This is great because it hadn't occurred to me before that we should expect magic all over the place in this book, because it's pretty clear in the novels that the emergence of these three dragons in Essos sort of reawakes magic all over the place.
Yeah. Right?
The alchemists, the, you know, Melisandre's or Beric Dondarrion's resurrection, yada, yada, yada. the warlocks of Qarth, they're all beneficiaries of the return of magic to the world in the shape of dragons. Well, now we're reading a book where there's, I don't know, 30, 40 more than that dragons running around.
Mm-hmm. Being born all the time.
Flying around.
Born, yeah.
We should expect there to be all kinds of magic and instances of magic that are not related specifically to the Targaryens. But we're seeing, I mean, aside from the occasional person that's like a woods witch or something like that, uh-huh. We're not seeing any of that.
Right. No, you're...
So I don't know. I honestly don't know why, you know, if three dragons pumps up the magic of everyone in the world, why we're not seeing more of that in this book.
Yeah, you know, because I remember being excited, like, when we saw the early history of Harrenhal and the early goings-on there, and there was, like, this throwaway line about perhaps a princess bathing in blood, and we've covered that before, but there wasn't a lot of, like, warlock and witchery. And especially when you think about, like, later the Blackfyre Rebellion, where fully, mm-hmm. like, a third, it seems, of the Targaryens were some form of warlock or witch. Like, Sierra She-Star was supposed to dabble in dark arts and blood magic, and the Blood Raven, who eventually becomes the Three-Eyed Crow, he was supposedly, like, a warlock that used portents and dark magic. Yeah. I mean, it's essentially dragons is the only kind of magic that is in the world, and they're not really. Maybe this is the Maester's bias, is that he's.
They're just big reptiles in this book, but
yeah,
yes, I was just gonna say maybe this is the Maester's bias because if you have these Maesters that are famously skeptical about magic,
right?
They're not, but we're not even hearing rumors, you know.
Yeah, because he's certainly not shy about giving weird, crazy rumors. Hearing so.
These maesters and septons and fools are so preoccupied with the Tower of Joy Dance that they cannot conceive of anything that doesn't relate to sex.
Yes, indeed, they're disciples of Mushroom. Can you talk about like the relation between, because like I've you know, we had a discussion when we were writing volume two where you're talking about in the Bible there's this encounter with one of the kings of Israel where he goes and visits the Witch of Endor,
yes.
No relation to the Ewoks, and he's wanting to get counsel from one of the dead prophets, Samuel, I think it is. Uh-huh. And we talked about, it's like, you know, because the Bible's not shy about talking about other gods and not even, you know, like, and ascribing them as, like, power as such. Like, obviously, Yahweh, yeah. Elohim, Jehovah, the Lord is the most powerful of them. But there's, you know, there's other gods mentioned. But then you've also got, yes. these things like the witch, like, and yeah. How did the ancient people differentiate between religious faith and those miracles and, like, yeah. witchery and warlock and sorcery and magic?
Well, I think the first thing we need to settle here is the dispute about whether or not the Witch of Endor actually does come from the moon of Endor.
Right.
Because this is debatable. She could have easily... It was a galaxy far, far away... But it's also very long ago, so
yeah.
she could have transported.
She's from trillions of light years and thousands yes. of years into the distant past of Earth.
The basic answer to this is that in the ancient world, the lines between magic and worship were very, very blurry, and this is one of the ways that I think. That George Martin represents the ancient mind better than Tolkien does, because if indeed Gandalf is known in Hobbiton for his amazing fireworks, then there's going to be a shrine to Gandalf in Hobbiton.
Oh, for sure.
That's how the ancient world. That's just how. How come we don't find any temples or you know churches or whatever in Middle Earth? Martin knows that if there is something that's unexplainable as you know, a a shadow baby that's birthed out of Melisandre, the ancient mind is going to try to make sense of that using religious narrative. So the difference between a witch and a shaman is that the witch is your enemy and the shaman is part of your tribe. And that's basically it. Mm. You don't call it magic unless it's some foreign person that you don't trust.
Mm.
Because your own magicians are only called that by your enemies. You call them wise men or sages shamans. Basically, the idea, the accusa in the ancient mind, this is especially true when Jesus is walking the earth. You don't call someone a magician unless you're suspicious that they're working in the dark arts. Mm. And of course, if one of your own tribe is performing these amazing things, then you're going to credit it to your own god, and this is all fine. Well, so basically, we're looking at xenophobia. That's how people get labeled witches and warlocks and sorcerers. This is xenophobia talking.
Ah, as it does as it talks so many times throughout human history.
Hey, man, this makes it all the way to the modern period. We were drowning witches for many, many centuries.
All right. That's all the feedback we got. If you'd like to send us more, of course, gameofthrones@baldmove.com. We are going to be back next week. We've got some exciting things happening. We're going to be closing out the last third of Fire and Blood. We're going to be closing out our coverage 2018 of Gods of Thrones and Fire and Blood. We're going to have Kim Renfro on to talk about her thoughts about Fire and Blood. Anthony will be rejoining me to talk about the last third. Hopefully, we'll hear from you guys and what you thought of the petering out of the dragons in what it seems like we're in for volume one of Fire and Blood. Don't forget, if you are moved to purchase Fire and Blood or our own book, Gods of Thrones, if our discussion with Anthony and myself has motivated to do so, you can find links to Gods of Thrones, our book, here in the show notes, and it's available in both ebook and physical book format. Again, you have plenty of time to order it now and get it for Christmas. For you or your loved ones, and we hope you do that. We'll be back next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Anthony.
See ya.